As Nash explained in his Madrid lecture, he had wanted to be declared a refugee from all NATO countries, but since he found himself in France, he had, so as not to be inconsistent, to settle for declaring himself only a refugee from the USA. Once again, he applied for asylum. When it became clear that the French were not going to grant it, Nash attempted to obtain a Swedish visa. This, too, was refused. He then turned to Hormander, who in turn consulted the Swedish Foreign Ministry and was told that without an American passport, Nash had no hope of obtaining a visa. Hormander, now impatient, wrote back, "Personally, I would strongly advise you to reconsider your views concerning NATO and other countries." Nash then managed a rather extraordinary feat. In early March, he traveled, alone and without passport, to East Germany. Hard as it is to believe that an American without documents could get into the DDR in 1960, Nash confirmed in 1995 that he had indeed traveled there, explaining that in his time of irrational thinking, he had gone places where you didn't need an American passport. What actually must have happened, given the tremendously tight security at the border at that time, was that Nash applied to the DDR for asylum and was then permitted by the authorities to enter the country until the request was decided. In any case, he went to Leipzig and stayed with a family named Turmer for several days. According to a card he sent Martha and Virginia, he was able, presumably as a guest of the government, to attend a famous propaganda event that happened to be taking place at the time, the Leipzig Industrial World Fair, which was the Iron Curtain's answer to the Brussels World Fair. Later, mathematicians in America would hear from Fahrenholt that Nash tried to defect to the Russians, but that the Russians had refused to have anything to do with him. That story, repeated by Felix Browder, is very probably based on Nash's Leipzig adventure. At least no evidence has turned up that Nash ever approached the Soviets. By that point, everyone involved, the Americans, the French, and presumably the DDR, was aware that Nash's actions were those of a very sick man. Apparently, however, the incident would prompt the FBI to raise questions about Alicia's security clearance in the early 1960s when she was working at RCA. In any case, Nash was eventually asked to leave East Germany, or quite possibly Fahrenholt got him out, and returned to Paris, where he wrote to Martha and Virginia that he was thinking of returning to Roanoke, but was worried about coming back to the United States when he had no guarantee that he would be able to leave again. As in Geneva, Nash spent much of his time sitting in the apartment writing letters. Michael Artin, the son of Princeton's Emil Artin, found a letter from Nash after the death of his father in his father's files. "It started out plausibly about mathematics," Artin recalled, "but it was stamped all over with metro tickets and tax stamps pasted on it. By the end of the letter, it was obvious that it was completely fantastic. It was about Kuckel's numbers for Mozart's symphonies. Kuckel had catalogued all of Mozart's works, more than 500. It was very graphic. It must have affected my father very much because he had kept it for all those years." Al Vasquez, the MIT undergraduate Nash had gotten to know in his final year in Cambridge, recalled, "His letters were filled with numerology. I didn't keep them. They weren't just letters. They were collages, pastiches, full of newspaper clippings, very clever. I was always showing them to people. They contained some insights, little patterns, puns." Kathleen Morowitz recalled that her father, John Singh, who had taught Nash tensor calculus at Carnegie, received postcards from Nash at this time and was frightened by them. They reminded him, he told her, of his brilliant brother Hutchie, who suffered from schizophrenia and had quit Trinity College in order to settle in the bohemian enclaves of Paris before the First World War. Morowitz said, "The letters were about things like Milner's differential structure of spheres. Nash would quote a theorem, then he'd derive a political meaning for it." Money was a growing worry. The Nash's lodgings were cheap by American standards, but living, particularly food, was not. Nash was greatly preoccupied with trying to sell his Mercedes, still in the Institute for Advanced Studies parking lot. The mathematician with whom he had left his car, Hassler Whitney, had called John Danskin and asked him to deal with it. John Abbott, a Frenchman who had invented a kind of bowling pin and was married to Odette's older sister Mouyou, got involved as well. The book value, Danskin recalled, was $2,300, but Nash was determined to get $2,400 or $2,500. He was absolutely unreasonable, Danskin recalled. I didn't sell it. It was still there when he got back. From time to time, Nash asked Martha to send Eleanor money. He also asked Warren Ambrose to visit John David, or perhaps Ambrose offered. Eleanor recalled that John David, now nearly 7, was frightened of Ambrose. Nash's hair had by now grown long, and he had a full beard. In early April, he sent Martha a photograph of himself taken in a Chinese restaurant, which he asked her to return to him, labeling it Picture of Dorian Gray. He referred to an autorisation de séjour for April 21st, and said that he was planning to leave soon for Sweden. On April 21st, Virginia received a telegram from the State Department requesting funds to bring Nash back to the United States. She wired the money. Nash was taken from the apartment on Avenue Rue de la République by the French police, who escorted him under guard all the way to Orly. Nash would later tell Vasquez that he had been brought back from Europe on a ship and in chains like a slave, but Alicia recalled quite definitely that they came back on a plane. While the departure repeated the trauma of Geneva, it was also a mirror image of their journey to France the previous summer. This time it was Nash who was the unwilling one. Ironically, in this, too, he was walking in Davis's path. For Davis, too, was once forcibly placed on the Queen Mary and sent back to America, confined in first-class quarters. Chapter 39, Absolute Zero, Princeton, 1960. The olive-green Mercedes 180 was still in the Institute parking lot in Princeton. Nash had come straight there, while Alicia and the baby went to Washington to stay with the Lardys. He hung around Princeton. In June, having heard that his sister had had a baby, Nash drove down to Roanoke to visit Martha in the hospital. She remembered being frightened by his appearance and concealing from him her son's due date, June 13th. "I was worried that he would put some meaning in it," she recalled in 1995. Her recollection is that Nash stayed in Roanoke with Virginia for several weeks. Alicia, meanwhile, was looking for work and had enlisted, among others, John Danskin, now married to Odette, to help her. Danskin was now teaching at Rutgers, and the newlyweds lived on the outskirts of Princeton. Alicia was apparently considering staying in Washington, presumably so that her parents could help with the baby. She was also thinking of moving back to New York. During the summer, Alicia stayed with her old MIT friend Joyce Davis, by now living in Greenwich Village and working in the city, and interviewed for various computer programming jobs. As she told Joyce in a note she left at her apartment on the day that she returned to Washington, she got offers from IBM and also from UNIVAC, but was undecided over whether to accept them, saying, "Now I've got a real problem. Work in New York or WASH." Odette urged Alicia to move to Princeton. Nash was also in favor. Alicia thought that her husband would benefit from being around other mathematicians again and hoped that he would be able to find work in Princeton. The upshot was that Alicia turned down the offers to work in New York City, and instead took a position with the Astroelectronics Division of the Radio Corporation of America, which had a big research facility on Hightstown Road between Princeton and Hightstown. Alicia left John Charles in her mother's care once more and rented a small apartment at 58 Spruce Street, on the corner of Walnut, about a mile from Palmer Square. Nash joined her there at the end of the summer. Initially, at least, Princeton seemed to offer a respite after the anxious final months in Paris. Alicia and Nash were very much part of a crowd that had gathered around John Danskin and Odette in the charming enclave near the Delaware Raritan Canal. Griggstown consisted at that time of Tornquist's, a general store, and a few picturesque houses, including the former cider mill where the Danskins lived. It was especially beautiful in the summer, the air heavy with the scent of honeysuckle. Naphtali Afriat, a game theorist who worked with Morgenstern at the time, lived there, as did Jean-Pierre Covin, a graduate student in French at Princeton, and a couple that worked at Rutgers, Agnes and Michael Sherman. The Danskins held frequent parties at which the Milners, Ed Nelson and his wife, and Georg Kreisel, a logician, were also frequent visitors. The parties lasted long into the night, with Beethoven sonatas, a great deal of wine, barbecued steaks and shish kebab, nighttime swims in the canal, and bright conversation led by the convivial, cultivated Mercurial Danskin. Gauvin remembered John Nash very vividly. He had a kind of childlike air and disposition, a gentleness, this very vulnerable quality, a kind of helplessness. It blew my mind that someone who gave this appearance of being so simple could be a genius. He was subdued and rather passive. He always spoke very softly and in a monotone. I don't recall him ever initiating a conversation. He would respond to a question or remark after a little momentary hesitation. Alicia was very attentive to him. Alicia was learning to drive. Danskin and Milner were both giving her lessons with haphazard success. They invited her along to a Thursday night folk dance group at Miss Fine's school on Route 206 that Danskin and Milner belonged to. She was very pretty, very quiet. I remember her pulling out a photograph of a cute little boy, said Elvira Leader. Her husband Sol danced with Alicia. She was weightless, he recalled. Danskin would bring the dancers home afterward. He remembered talking with Nash about mathematics. They'd been drinking by then. Danskin was trying to prove a theorem. He immediately hit you with the hardest point. He was still very sharp. He understood what I was doing. I wanted to avoid the hard way, and he caught me. Who in the hell would ask that? You would if you were proving it yourself, but he was just listening. And understanding. Danskin spearheaded an effort to find Nash a job. Danskin was doing some consulting work for Oscar Morgenstern, and Morgenstern, it seemed, was willing to hire Nash as a consultant. That fall, Nash was given a one-year consulting contract with a ceiling of $2,000. Morgenstern indicated to the university that he was making the offer under a small charitable pressure, but that he felt Nash could contribute strongly to his program if he was able to pull out of his present mental depression and utilize his faculties to their greatest extent. The university balked, fearing that the appointment might be based on human kindness rather than on realistic technical needs. It was decided to review Nash's performance after 2 months. The contract was dated October 21, 1960. Nash, however, was talking about returning to France. He contacted Jean Leray, who was visiting at the Institute for Advanced Study, asking Leray to invite him once more to the Collège de France. This time, Alicia, much alarmed, intervened. She asked Donald Spencer, the mathematician at Princeton who had helped Nash work out the final version of his paper on algebraic varieties in 1950 and 1951, to write to Leray to ask that Leray discourage Nash from going to France again so soon. Her advice is not to invite John to France at the present time, since she feels it will only stir him up again. If this job, with Oscar Morgenstern, materializes, it will have a quieting effect on her husband. She feels that remaining in Princeton for a time might possibly bring him back to mathematical work. By now, Nash had been in the grip of unremitting psychotic illness for nearly 2 years. It had transformed him. The change in Nash's appearance and manner made it surprising that his old friends from the mathematics department recognized him at all. The man who walked up and down the main street of Princeton in the stifling summer of 1960 was clearly disturbed. He would go into restaurants with bare feet. With dark hair to his shoulders and a bushy black beard, he had a fixed expression, a dead gaze. Women especially found him frightening. He looked no one in the eye. Nash spent most of his time hanging around the university, including Fine Hall. Most days he wore a smock-like Russian peasant garment. He seemed, as one graduate student at the time remembered, to talk to the squirrels. He carried around a notebook, a scrapbook entitled Absolute Zero, in which he pasted all sorts of things, presumably a reference to the rock-bottom temperature at which all activity ceases. He was fascinated by bright colors. He was often in the common room, where he liked to spectate, to watch people playing Kriegspiel, and to make cryptic little remarks. On one occasion, when William Feller was standing nearby, for example, Nash said to no one in particular, "What would we do with an overweight Hungarian?" On another, "What does Spain and Sinai have in common?" This was after Israel's takeover of the Sinai. He answered his own question, "They both start with S." Everyone around Fine knew who he was, of course. The senior faculty tended to avoid him, and the Fine Hall secretaries were slightly afraid of him, as his size and strange manner gave him a somewhat threatening air. On one occasion, Nash disquieted the formidable Agnes Henry, the departmental secretary, by asking her for the sharpest pair of scissors she possessed. Henry was taken aback, and consulted Al Tucker about what to do. Tucker, who was walking with a cane at that time and would hardly have been Nash's match, said, "Well, give it to him, and if there's trouble, I'll handle it." Nash grabbed the scissors, walked over to a phone book that was lying out, and cut out the cover, a map of the Princeton area in primary colors. He pasted it in his notebook. He found a few graduate students to talk to. Burton Randall, then a first-year mathematics graduate student, recalled, "I wasn't bothered by his strangeness, and I wasn't afraid of him physically. I was willing to have conversations with him. In some sense, we enjoyed each other." He and Nash would take long, rambling walks around Princeton, and Randall particularly recalled Nash's wry sense of humor, which he remembered as intentional, self-referential, and self-deprecating. He knew he was crazy, and he made little jokes about it. He referred to himself obliquely and usually in the third person as one Johann von Nassau, a mysterious figure whose name was curiously similar to John von Neumann's and suggested a connection with Nassau Street, the main street of Princeton, as well as Nassau Hall, the main building on the university campus. He talked in rather lofty terms of world peace and world government, making it clear he was in touch with these ideas on some very grand scale, though he rarely, if ever, alluded to his actual experiences in Paris and Geneva. The job with Morgenstern fell through. As Danskin recalled, Nash refused to fill out the necessary W-2 forms, claiming that he was a citizen of Liechtenstein and not subject to taxes. "I got him a job in the economic research group by calling Oscar Morgenstern," Oscar said, "fine. I got an application. It called for his social security number and asked whether he was a citizen of the U.S. He wouldn't cooperate, so he didn't get the job." Whether this was why the contract was canceled in early December, or whether by then it was obvious that Nash was far too sick to work, was unclear. Nash was also writing all sorts of letters to people. When he heard that Martin Shubik was applying game theory to the theory of money, he sent Shubik a Richie Rich comic book. He sent Paul Zweifel, his friend from Carnegie, postcards in care of the French Charge d'Affaires at the French Embassy in Washington. Nash was also making a great many telephone calls, usually, as Martha recalled, using fictitious names. Ed Nelson recalled, "I did my part by talking to John on the telephone during those years. He used to call me a lot." And Armin Burrell recalled, "I got unending phone calls from Nash. Harish Chandra also often got calls. It was endless. It was all nonsense. Numerology, dates, world affairs. This was really painful. It was very often." Nash's bizarre behavior was attracting the attention of university officials. Danskin recalled, "He was irritating the president of the university. He was talking about something that was going on in the Gaza Strip. He was playing hopscotch on campus. Goheen's secretary called me. He wasn't threatening anyone, but he was behaving crazily. He would go into the offices, the young women would be frightened. At my house, he'd play with my stereo and screw it up. He frightened people. But he was the gentlest person imaginable." Alicia was beside herself. She had become quite depressed. Members of a folk dancing group remember her sad expression, her showing them pictures of her baby, and her sadness at being separated from her son. She began seeing a psychiatrist at the Princeton Hospital, Philip Ehrlich, who urged her to have her husband hospitalized against his will, if necessary. He recommended a nearby state hospital. Odette recalled in 1995, "It was awful that such a strong and handsome man should be locked up. Alicia had some guilt trips. We talked it over back and forth. The doctors advised her. She didn't understand. It was very painful." Alicia had initially asked John Danskin to commit Nash. Danskin refused. She then turned to Virginia and Martha. A day or two before the police picked Nash up, Nash showed up on campus covered with scratches. "Johann von Nassau has been a bad boy," he said, visibly terrified. "They're going to come get me now." Chapter 40, Tower of Silence, Trenton State Hospital, 1961. Reposing in the midst of the most beautiful scenery in the valley of the Delaware, combining all the influences which human art and skill can command to bless, soothe and restore the wandering intellects that are gathered in its bosom. First Annual Report of the New Jersey State Lunatic Asylum, 1848. I'm as if left to rot in a tower of silence, with anti-Promethean vultures gnawing away at my vitals. John Nash, 1967. At the end of January, 10 months after Nash's return from Paris, a much-aged Virginia Nash and her daughter Martha boarded a train in Roanoke and traveled north all day, arriving at Princeton in the late afternoon. The last time they had made this trip together was a decade earlier to attend Johnny's graduation, and the contrast between that trip and the present one was much on their minds. As they disembarked, tearful and weary, John Milner, now a full professor in the Princeton Mathematics Department, was waiting for them. It was nearly dark and already snowing lightly. After a few awkward exchanges, Milner showed them his car, turned over the keys, and gave them directions to West Trenton. Martha took the wheel, and the two women drove in silence down Route 1, the car slipping and sliding on the thin layer of slick ice that now covered the road. They were almost thankful for the distraction. They dreaded what lay ahead. Johnny was already at the Trenton State Hospital. He had been picked up earlier in the day by the police, taken first to Princeton Hospital, a small general hospital, and then transported by ambulance to Trenton State. Now they were going down to talk to the doctors, sign the necessary forms, and, if possible, see Johnny. They would see Alicia, at whose apartment they were staying, afterward. Full of doubt and self-reproach, they felt they had little choice but to accede to another commitment. Whatever hope they had that Johnny's settling in Princeton, in familiar surroundings and among old mathematical acquaintances, would bring about some improvement in his condition, had been shattered weeks before. Alicia's telephone calls had become increasingly frantic. The psychiatrist whom Alicia had been in touch with had tried without success to convince Johnny to go into the hospital on his own. Johnny had been dead set against the idea. Finally, the three women had agreed among themselves that there was no other way. He would have to go. And this time it wouldn't be to a private hospital. As Martha recalled in 1995, "At first we had thought that 30 days at McLean would straighten him out. By then we knew there were no short-term answers. We were concerned that John's illness would eat into Mother's capital and that she couldn't afford a private hospital." In the moonlight and freshly fallen snow, the gray stone building with its white marble dome and tall columns, set atop a gentle wooded slope, looked reassuringly solid and respectable. Institutions like the Trenton State Hospital owed their existence to the same mid-19th century reform movements that opposed slavery and advanced women's suffrage. Many, in fact, owed their existence to the efforts of Dorothea Dix, a fiery, single-minded Unitarian who made the appalling plight of the insane, condemned to almshouses, prisons, and the streets, her life's crusade. When she was old, ill, and penniless, Dix lived on the ground floor of Trenton's administration building in an apartment set aside for her by the trustees of Trenton State, until her death in 1887. Like all such institutions, Trenton hardly evolved as its founder anticipated. In particular, it was soon overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of people who sought, or whose families sought on their behalf, shelter there. During World War II, Trenton State, long since expanded from a single large building into a large complex, had an average of 4,000 patients. The census dropped sharply after the war, but was rising rapidly in the late 1950s. By 1961, there were nearly 2,500 patients, 10 times as many as at a private hospital like McLean. Staffing was minimal and consisted mostly of young foreign residents. The 600 patients in the so-called West Hospital, for example, were cared for by 6 psychiatrists. The 500 chronic patients in the annex, predominantly senile or epileptic, were cared for by just 1 doctor. The presence of a large number of chronic patients obscured the fact that most patients who came to Trenton stayed a relatively short time, perhaps 3 months. "You really were not close to patients," said Dr. Peter Baumecker, who worked at both the hospital's insulin unit and the rehabilitation ward during Nash's stay. "The poorest and sickest patients wound up at Trenton." "I remember very few patients specifically," Baumecker said. "There was one patient who gouged out the eye of another. There was another patient who'd lost his eye when the police beat him up after he'd killed his father. But that was very exceptional. There were good wards and bad wards. Trenton was not as plush as other places. As a matter of fact, Trenton was pretty crummy, recalled Baumecker in 1995. But I remember a lot of warmth, a lot of caring. We helped an awful lot of people. Later, Nash would recall with great bitterness the fact that he was assigned a serial number at Trenton, as if he were an inmate of a prison. To occupy a room shared by 30 or 40 others, to be forced to wear clothes that are not your own, to have no place, not even a locker, for your things, even your own soap or shaving cream, is an experience that few people can imagine. Yet this is how Nash, a man who craved, because of his nature and the nature of his illness, solitude and mobility, lived for the next 6 months, surrounded by strangers. If he had dreaded military duty, what must this have been like for him? Nash would have been brought to Peyton I, the men's admitting ward on the ground floor of Peyton, off to the right of the main administration building. Baumecker was in charge of admissions then and conducted the initial interview. "Nash was my patient," said Baumecker. "He didn't like me because my name started with a B. He had something against the letter B." The admission interview took place in a small admitting room that had a cot, a couple of chairs, a desk, and a small window. Baumecker asked Nash the usual questions, such as, "Do you hear voices?" He tried to find out whether Nash had delusions and whether they were elaborate. He watched his expressions to see whether the emotions he showed were appropriate to what he was saying. The hijacking of a Portuguese ocean liner, the Santa Maria, off Caracas that week, and the subsequent efforts of the hijackers, who turned out to be anti-Salazar rebels, to obtain asylum in Brazil, was, it seemed, very much on Nash's mind. He had his own private theory about it. The following morning, Nash's case was presented to the staff, and he was interviewed in the dormitory before a group of residents. That was when the preliminary diagnosis was reached, treatment was decided upon, and he was assigned a psychiatrist. One wound up in Trenton if one had no money or insurance, or was too sick for a private institution to handle. The decision to commit Nash to an overcrowded, underfunded, and understaffed state institution seems puzzling in retrospect. Alicia had at least some insurance coverage through her position at RCA, and Virginia, although by now worried that her son's treatment would eat into her capital, was surely able to pay for some private care. Martha and Virginia certainly had their misgivings. We went down to talk to them, to beg them to put a red flag on the case and pay special attention to John. It was the only state hospital that John ever stayed in. John Danskin recalled, "I'd heard he was in Trenton. I called his family and said, 'For God's sake, do something.' I drove down to Trenton State. I wanted to find out what the hell happened. I was shocked. It wasn't brutal, but he was being treated rather roughly. The attendant kept calling him Johnny. I told the people there, 'This is the legendary John Nash.' He was all right, too. He gave me no sign at all of being out of his mind. I kept thinking, 'My God, these shrinks! Who's going to figure out what's wrong with a genius?' I resented them." News that Nash had been committed to a state hospital spread quickly around Princeton. One person deeply disturbed by the notion that a genius like Nash was incarcerated at a state hospital, notorious for its overcrowding and aggressive medical treatments, including drugs, electroshock, and insulin coma therapy, was Robert Winters. Winters, a Harvard-trained economist who happened to be the business manager of the physics department at the time, was friendly with both Al Tucker and Don Spencer. Winters contacted Joseph Tobin, the Institute for Advanced Studies psychiatric consultant and director of the Neuropsychiatric Institute in Hopewell, which is a few miles from Princeton, calling him in late January to say, "It is in the national interest that everything possible be done to bring Professor Nash back to his original productive self." Tobin suggested that Winters contact Harold McGee, Trenton's medical director at the time. Winters did so and won an assurance from McGee, as he later wrote to Tobin, that there would be a thorough study of Dr. Nash's condition before any treatment was started at the state hospital. In truth, this was too much to expect. As Seymour Krim, a beat writer in New York, wrote in 1959 in his essay The Insanity Bit about his own experiences in mental hospitals, that work in a flip factory is determined by mathematics. You must find the common denominator of categorization and treatment in order to handle the battalions of miscellaneous humanity that are marched past your desk with high trumpets blowing in their minds. Very soon after that assurance was given, or perhaps even before, Nash was transferred from Peyton to Dix 1, the insulin unit. Ehrlich, the psychiatrist at Princeton Hospital who had recommended Trenton, was convinced that Nash would benefit from the treatments available at Trenton. Whether Alicia, Virginia, or Martha gave explicit consent for insulin coma therapy is not clear. "I don't remember whether the family had to give further permissions beyond the commitment," Baumecker recalled. "In those days you could do just about anything without asking anybody." Martha recalled that she was consulted. "That was a drastic decision. We were extra wary of anything that might affect his mental abilities. We discussed this with doctors." The insulin unit was the most elite unit within Trenton State Hospital. The unit had two separate wards, one with 22 male beds, the other with 22 female beds. Danskin later described it as looking like the inside of the Lincoln Tunnel. Its chief had the eye and ear of the hospital's directors. It had the most doctors, the best nurses, the nicest furnishings. Only patients who were young and in good health were sent there. Patients on the insulin unit had special diets, special treatment, special recreation. "All the best of what the hospital had to offer was showered on them," said Robert Garber, who was a staff psychiatrist at Trenton in the early 1940s and later president of the American Psychiatric Association. He said, "The insulin patients got a hell of a lot of TLC. In the family's eyes, insulin had great appeal." Patients' relatives were overwhelmed. For the next 6 weeks, 5 days a week, Nash endured the insulin treatments. Very early in the morning, a nurse would wake him and give him an insulin injection. By the time Baumecker got to the ward at 8:30, Nash's blood sugar would already have dropped precipitously. He would have been drowsy, hardly aware of his surroundings, perhaps half delirious, and talking to himself. One woman used to yell, jump in the lake, all the time. By 9:30 or 10, Nash would be comatose, sinking deeper and deeper into unconsciousness until at one stage, his body would become as rigid as if it were frozen solid and his fingers would be curled. At that point, a nurse would put a rubber hose through his nose and esophagus, and a glucose solution would be administered. Sometimes, if necessary, this would be done intravenously. Then he would wake up, slowly and agonizingly, with nurses hovering over him. By 11 in the morning, Nash would be conscious again, and by the late afternoon, when the whole group would walk over to occupational therapy, he would be among them, the nurses bringing along orange juice in case anyone felt faint. Very often during the comatose stage, patients whose blood sugar levels dropped too far would have spontaneous seizures, thrashing around, biting their tongues. Broken bones were not uncommon. Sometimes patients remained in the coma. "We lost one young man," recalled Baumecker. "We'd all become very alarmed. We'd call in experts and do all kinds of things. Sometimes patients would get very hot and we'd pack them in ice." Good first-hand accounts of the experience are difficult to find, in part because the treatment destroys large blocks of recent memory. Nash would later describe insulin therapy as torture, and he resented it for many years afterward, sometimes giving as a return address on a letter, "Insulin Institute." A hint of how unpleasant it was can be gleaned from the account of another patient. "Breaking through the first sodden layers of consciousness, the smell of fresh wool, they make me come back every day, day after day, back from the nothingness. The sickness, the taste of blood in my mouth, my tongue is raw, the gag must have slipped today. The foggy pain in my head, this was my unbroken routine for 3 months. Very little of it is clear in retrospect, save the agony of emerging from shock every day." It's true, as Garber said, that insulin patients were coddled compared to others at Trenton. Insulin patients got richer and more varied food. They got special desserts. They had ice cream every night at bedtime. Most had ground privileges and permission to go out on weekend visits. All the patients gained weight. That was considered a good sign. The doctors on the ward were proud that their patients were in good physical health. "People would put on a lot of weight because of the insulin," recalled Baumecker. The low blood sugar would make it necessary to give them a lot of sugar, and the sugar had a lot of calories. For some of these spindly, skinny schizophrenics, it wasn't such a bad thing. But patients often hated it. Nash's subsequent obsession with his diet and weight may well have stemmed from this experience of being force-fed. Treating schizophrenic patients with insulin coma was the idea of Manfred Sackel, a Viennese physician who thought of it during the 1920s and used it on psychotic patients, especially ones with schizophrenia, in the mid-1930s. His notion was that if the brain were deprived of sugar, which is what keeps it going, the cells that were functioning marginally would die. It would be like radiation treatments for cancer. Some practitioners who used it in the 1950s, when the first effective antipsychotic drugs became available, took the view that insulin shock was more effective than antipsychotics, especially with regard to delusional thinking. No one understood the mechanism, but two large-scale studies in the late 1930s found that insulin-treated patients had better and more lasting outcomes than untreated individuals. But evidence for insulin's efficacy was hardly overwhelming. It was in any case riskier and far more involved than electroshock. And by 1960, insulin shock therapy had been phased out by most hospitals as too dangerous and expensive when compared with electroshock. The conclusion was that insulin wasn't worth the investment of time and money, or the risks. The treatments produced at least temporary improvement in many patients, according to Garber. They'd see everyone hovering over them, very concerned about them, a feeling of loving camaraderie. I always thought that was very therapeutic. For the first time, somebody cared. Patients became more outgoing, more active. They got to go out on weekend visits. They got ground privileges. I think it helped. Patients were brighter, more alert, more conversational. While Nash later blamed the treatments for large gaps in his memory, he also told his cousin Richard Nash, whom he visited in San Francisco in 1967, that, "I didn't get better until the money ran out and I went to a public hospital." As dangerous and agonizing as it was, insulin was one of the few treatments available for serious illnesses like schizophrenia, which until the middle of the century often meant lifelong incarceration. And like other state hospitals, Trenton was a laboratory for every cure that came along. Before the war, Garber recounted, "We treated all patients with the tools that were available. Colonic irrigation was still used. So was fever therapy. We had a strain of malaria that we would inoculate patients with. Later on, we used a typhoid strain. We'd inject a typhoid vaccine, and within hours, patients would experience nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, fevers of 104 to 105. We'd do that for 8 or 10 weeks, 2 or 3 days a week. We did it to take the starch out of disturbed patients. At Trenton, the first order of the day when I arrived at the hospital supervisor's office at 8 a.m. was to see who could be moved out of seclusion to make room for another 8 to 15 patients who needed to be secluded. The rooms were 10 by 12, lined with glazed tiles with terrazzo floors. There was a toilet and a sink and a drain in the middle of the room, so that if a patient, say, smeared feces around the room, we could hose it down. You would do anything to give yourself a handle to bring the patient under control." After 6 weeks, Nash, whose insulin treatments were judged to be effective, was transferred to Ward 6, the so-called rehab or parole ward. There was group therapy every day, some recreation, and occupational therapy. "This was the cream of the patient crop," Baumecker recalled. "There were only about 15 beds. Other wards had 30 patients per room. Patients got individual attention, went on trips, and were allowed to go home on visits." Nash actually began to work on a paper on fluid dynamics while he was on Ward 6. Baumecker recalled, "The patients made fun of him because he was always so up in the clouds. Professor," one of them said on one occasion, "let me show you how one uses a broom." Alicia visited Nash every week. Once he was allowed out on passes, she took him to her folk dancing group and out to Swift's Colonial Diner. It was the highlight of Nash's week. He seemed to be in remission, clearly no longer a threat to himself or others. Baumecker recommended him for discharge, pointing out that contrary to the popular belief, we had to discharge people as fast as we could to get the census down. He was discharged on July 15th, a month after his 33rd birthday. A few months after Nash got out, Baumecker called the Institute for Advanced Study and asked to speak to Oppenheimer about whether Nash was now sane. Oppenheimer replied, "That's something no one on Earth can tell you, Doctor." Chapter 41. An Interlude of Enforced Rationality. July 1961 to April 1963. When I had been long enough hospitalized, I would finally renounce my delusional hypotheses and revert to thinking of myself as a human of more conventional circumstances. John Nash, Nobel Autobiography, 1995. A man experiencing a remission of a physical illness may feel a renewed sense of vitality and delight in resuming his old activities. But someone who has spent months and years feeling privy to cosmic, even divine insights, and now feels such insights are no longer his to enjoy, is bound to have a very different reaction. For Nash, the recovery of his everyday rational thought processes produced a sense of diminution and loss. The growing relevance and clarity of his thinking, which his doctor, wife, and colleagues hailed as an improvement, struck him as a deterioration. In his autobiographical essay written after he won the Nobel, Nash writes that rational thought imposes a limit on a person's concept of his relation to the cosmos. He refers to remissions not as joyful returns to a healthy state, but as interludes, as it were, of enforced rationality. His regretful tone brings to mind the words of Lawrence, a young man with schizophrenia who invented a theory of psychomathematics, and told Rutgers psychologist Louis Sass, "People kept thinking I was regaining my brilliance, but what I was really doing was retreating to simpler and simpler levels of thought." It is possible, naturally, that Nash's feeling reflected an actual dulling of his cognitive capacities relative not just to his exalted states, but to his abilities before the onset of his psychosis. The consciousness of how much his circumstances in life, not to mention his prospects, were altered, compounded his distress. At 33, he was out of work, branded a former mental patient, and dependent on the kindness of former colleagues. Excerpts from a letter to Donald Spencer, written around the time of Nash's release from Trenton on July 15th, suggest how modest Nash's view of reality had become. "In my situation and anticipated situation, a fellowship, with the idea being that I am expected to be doing research work and studies, etc., seems a better prospect than a standard academic teaching position. For one thing, much of the conceivable worry over the implications of my having been in a state mental hospital would be thereby bypassed." With the help of Spencer, who was on the Princeton faculty, and several members of the permanent mathematics faculty at the Institute for Advanced Study, Armand Burrell, Atlee Selberg, Marston Morse, and Dean Montgomery, a one-year research appointment at the Institute was arranged. Oppenheimer found $6,000 of National Science Foundation money to support Nash. Nash's application, dated July 19, 1961, stated that he wished to continue the study of partial differential equations and mentioned other research interests, some related to my earlier work, as well. In late July, Alicia's mother brought John Charles, a big, handsome 2-year-old, to Princeton. Nash called the reunion a big occasion for me since I haven't seen our little boy all during 1961. Then, at the beginning of August, Nash attended a mathematics conference in Colorado where he ran into a number of old acquaintances and went on a day-long excursion with Spencer, an enthusiastic mountaineer, to climb Pike's Peak. Nash and Alicia were living together once more, but not especially happily. The turbulence of the two previous years had produced an accumulation of hurts and resentments, and the resulting coldness lingered and was exacerbated by new conflicts over money, child-rearing, and other issues of daily living. None of this was made easier by the fact that Nash's in-laws now lived with them. Carlos Larde's health had deteriorated markedly, and he and his wife Alicia moved to Princeton that fall. The two couples shared a house at 137 Spruce Street. It was a great help that Mrs. Larde cared for Johnny while Alicia went to work, but living together created another layer of strain, especially for Alicia. They tried to make the best of it. Nash attempted to care for his son, picking him up at nursery school and the like. They socialized with the Nelsons, the Milners, and a few others. Once or twice they drove up to Massachusetts to visit John and Odette Danskin, who had moved there the previous fall, and to see John Steer. The visits were rather fraught, and Eleanor used to call John Danskin afterward to complain about Nash. On one visit, apparently, Nash had come with a bag of donuts. Eleanor kept saying, "How cheap," Odette recalled. In early October, Nash attended a most historic conference in Princeton. The conference, organized by Oscar Morgenstern and attended by virtually the entire game theory community, amounted to a celebration of cooperative theory. There was little mention of non-cooperative games or bargaining. But John Harzanyi, a Hungarian, Reinhard Selten, a German, and John Nash, dressed in odd mismatched clothing, mostly silent, were all there. This was the first time these three men had met, and they would not meet again until they traveled to Stockholm a quarter of a century later to accept Nobel Prizes. Arzanyi remembers asking one of the Princeton people why Nash said so little during the sessions. The answer, Arzanyi recalled in a conversation in Jerusalem in 1995, was, "He was afraid he would say something strange and humiliate himself." Nash was able to work again, something he had not been able to do for nearly 3 years. He turned once more to the mathematical analysis of the motion of fluids and certain types of nonlinear partial differential equations that can be used as models for such flows. He finished his paper on fluid dynamics, begun while he was in Trenton State Hospital. It was titled Le problème de Cauchy pour les équations différentielles d'un fluide général, and was published in 1962 in a French mathematical journal. The paper, which Nash and others have described as quite a respectable piece of work, and which the Encyclopedic Dictionary of Mathematics called basic and noteworthy, eventually inspired a good deal of subsequent work on the so-called Cauchy problem for the general Navier-Stokes equations. In the paper, Nash was able to prove the existence of unique regular solutions in local time. After Nash's hospitalization, he came out and seemed okay, Atlee Selberg recalled. It was good for him to be at the IAS. Not everybody on the Princeton faculty was very friendly. It's true that he didn't speak. He wrote everything on blackboards. He was perfectly articulate in writing. He gave a lecture on Navier-Stokes equations, which concern hydrodynamics and partial differential equations, something I don't know much about. He seemed fairly normal for a while. He was most at ease in one-on-one encounters where his sense of humor came to his aid. Gillian Richardson, who was on the staff of the Institute's Computer Center from 1959 to 1962, recalled eating lunch with Nash in the Institute dining hall, and Nash's saying all sorts of dry, wry things about psychiatrists. One time he asked, "Do you know a good psychiatrist in Princeton?" adding that his own psychiatrist sat on a throne way above him, and he wondered if I knew one who didn't share that peculiarity. Nash showed up in French 105, the third semester French course at the university, one day, and asked Carl Witte if he could audit it. He struck the French professor as the typically dreamy and out-to-lunch mathematician. Nash attended quite regularly and kept up the work. He seemed less interested in picking up conversational tourist French than in acquiring a sense of French structure, Witte recalled, adding, "He was quite pro-French. He liked the language and the people." Witte and Nash became rather friendly and met outside class, and on a number of occasions with Alicia. At some point, Witte asked Nash why he was learning French. Nash answered that he was writing a mathematical paper. There was only one person in the world who would be able to understand it, and that person was French. He wanted, therefore, to write the paper in French, Witte said. Witte could not recall Nash's intended audience. Chances are it was either Luray, who was at the Institute that year, or Grothendieck. After the paper was published, Nash gave it to another member of the Institute to read. The next time he saw the man, Nash asked him, "Did you detect the sexual overtones?" Witte commented in 1997, "That was the time that de Gaulle was in power and strong pressure was being exerted on French scientists to deliver their papers in French. Nash always struck me as very well-bred, very courteous. I'm certain that there was in his mind a sense of respect for whomever he was writing the paper for. It was sweet of him, and I liked him for it." Nash asked Jean-Pierre Covin to edit a draft of the paper. Covin, who was doing quite a bit of translation work at the time, recalled Nash's telling him that Paris was the center for this kind of mathematics. Nash also turned to a French undergraduate, Hubert Goldschmidt, for help. Nash had not given up the idea of returning to France. He submitted the Cauchy paper to the Bulletin de la Société Mathématique de France on January 19th. He was, Covin thought, more withdrawn and subdued than ever, and in retrospect it is clear that he was thinking a great deal about leaving Princeton. Very likely he got in touch with Grothendieck at the Institut des Hautes Études Scientifiques. In April, Oppenheimer wrote to Léon Moschen, director of the IHES, to ask Moschen to formally invite Nash to spend the first half of the academic year 1963-64 there. Oppenheimer also asked Leray, who was at the Institute that year, to see if he could provide a grant from the Centre de la Recherche Nationale Scientifique for the second half of the year. At the same time, he noted that Nash would have been welcome to continue at the Institute for a second year. If Nash asked to stay here for the autumn, I think that my colleagues would probably accede, but that is not his choice. Nash did not suggest that Alicia go with him to France, and this time Alicia did not try to dissuade him. Nor did she offer to go. It was clear that by some mutual and unspoken agreement the marriage was over, and they were going to go their separate ways. That winter Nash spent more and more time in the Fine Hall common room, usually showing up at tea time and staying until evening. He wore baggy, rumpled clothes, Stefan Burr, then a graduate student, recalled. He didn't seem at all aggressive. In some ways, his manner was not that different from a lot of mathematicians. For a while, Burr and Nash were playing endless games of hex. The board in Fine had been drawn years before on heavy cardboard, and was so worn that the lines had constantly to be redrawn with a ballpoint pen. It was beginning to seem less well again. Burrell recalled, "He was not quite right. He seemed to me very diminished. His mathematics was not at the same level. I found him odd, unpredictable, nonsensical. It was very painful. The secretaries were afraid of him. He was someone to avoid. You never knew what he would do or say." One time the Burrells had Alicia and Nash over for tea. "We serve tea and cookies," said Burrell. Nash went into the kitchen. I followed him. "What do you want?" I asked. "Well, I'd like some salt and pepper." Gabby Burrell added, "After he put salt and pepper in his tea, he complained that the tea tasted awful." During the spring, his state of mind had become more angry and restless, and he was beginning again to harp on his old obsessions. He decided rather suddenly to travel to the West Coast, where he saw, among others, Al Vasquez, who had graduated from MIT and was now a graduate student at Berkeley, Lloyd Shapley, and Al Tucker's former wife, Alice Beckenbach, and her new husband. Vasquez recalled, "I just walked into the common room at Berkeley, and he was there. He was as surprised to see me as I was to see him. He didn't announce his visits in advance. I had no idea where he was staying, but he was around for more than just a day or two. He hadn't been looking for me. I had the impression that he'd been in Europe, the East Coast, and that he was traveling around. He talked a lot. He quite explicitly talked about insulin shock therapy. He described shock therapy as extremely painful. He also said he was taken back from Europe on a ship and in chains. Slavery was a word he used a lot. He was very bitter about his experiences. He was pretty disoriented. He wasn't able to talk about anything else but his obsessions. I was put off. It was odd. I never did understand why he talked to me. He knew me. He wasn't really trying to communicate. He wanted to talk elusively. Yet it wasn't gibberish. It was even clever at times, full of puns and allusions." Shapley, to whom Nash had written a great many letters, also found Nash's appearance in Santa Monica distressing. "He thought of me as a close friend. One had to put up with it. He would send me postcards in colored inks. It was very sad. They were scribbled with math and numerology, as if he were not expecting a reply. I was much on his mind. He had decayed in a very spectacular way," Shapley recalled in 1994. "He was groping." Shapley remembered Nash telling him, "I have this problem. I think I can straighten it out if I can figure out which members of the mass society did this to me." He didn't stay long, Shapley said, adding, It was a bit frightening. We had two young children. What was clear was that there was no way to talk to him or even follow what he was saying. He'd switch from topic to topic. It's very hard to be a good mathematician if you can't hold a thought in your mind. In June, Nash left for Europe. He was due to attend a conference in Paris in the last week of June and the World Mathematical Congress in Stockholm in early August. He went to London first, where he stayed at the Hotel Russell in Bloomsbury, which he described as very grand. He got himself a private postal box and was once again writing letters, some on toilet paper, in green ink in French. He was also sending drawings, including one of a prostrate figure pierced with arrows. One, postmarked June 14th, contained a scrap of paper with the following written on it in green ink. 2+5+20+8+12+15+18+15+13=78. The conference at the Collège de France in Paris was a small and intimate affair, very much dominated by Leray, who was very excited at that time about nonlinear hyperbolic equations. Ed Nelson, who had become quite friendly with Nash over the academic year, recalled Leray's saying that it was a scandal that there were no global existence theorems. "The feeling he conveyed," Nelson said, "was that we had better get to work or the world might come to an end at any moment." Most of the speakers gave their talks in English. Lars Hormander, who was also there, recalled that 1962 was very different from earlier visits. But Nash insisted on giving his lecture in what he called his pidgin French. He did not speak extemporaneously, but read from his notes in his very soft voice, and with his very strong American accent. Hormander recalled, "Nash's paper was respectable mathematically. It was a surprise to all of us that he could have produced it at all. For us it was like seeing somebody rise from the grave." His behavior, however, was decidedly odd, Hormander later said. Malgrange, the official conference organizer, had a dinner for the participants. At the table, Nash exchanged his plate with the person next to him. Then he traded yet again until he was satisfied that his food wasn't poisoned. Everybody was very aware of his bizarre behavior, but nobody said a word. Malgrange had bought a nice big jar of caviar, which was being passed around. When the jar came to Nash, he tipped the entire thing upside down onto his plate. Everybody was very well behaved and said nothing. While Nash was still in Paris on July 2nd, his father-in-law suddenly died. Alicia attempted, through Milner and Danskin, to contact Nash, but was not successful. Carlos Larday was buried in the churchyard of St. Paul's on Nassau Street. Nash, meanwhile, went back to London. What drew him to London is not clear, since his original plan had been presumably to spend the summer, except for the Congress in Stockholm, as well as the following academic year, in Paris. In any event, Nash was still in London on July 24th when he wrote to Martha from the Hotel Stefan on Talbot Square. He apparently still intended to travel on to Stockholm. Addressing her as Emmeline, Martha's middle name, he wrote that he was merely passing time with little to do until the Mathematical Congress in Stockholm, and was considering seeing a psychologist or visiting some sort of clinic. Danskin recalled that someone went looking for Nash and finally found him hanging around the Chinese embassy in London. The head of the MIT economics department took a group of business management people to London that summer. He suddenly saw John Nash and asked him, "Where are you now?" Puzzled, Nash replied, "Where are you?" The International Mathematical Congress took place in the third week of August in Stockholm. Among the plenary speakers were Armin Burrell, John Milner, and Louis Nirenberg. The Fields Medals were awarded to Milner and Lars Hormander, both of whom had been notified in May and instructed to tell no one, leaving each to sit on his secret while others around them speculated on the year's likely winners. Nash, who felt that he should have been one of those honored, did not, however, go to Stockholm. He went to Geneva instead, returning to the Hotel Alba, where he had spent his final week in December 1959, and writing in French to Martha, chez Charles L. Legge. The letter made it clear that he was again thinking about the question of his identity. He drew an identity card with Chinese characters labeled Des Secrets. He wrote, "Could you sign this carte d'identité? A man all alone in a strange world," he wrote underneath. He sent Virginia another postcard with a picture of Geneva, but mailed it from Paris. When Nash returned to Princeton at the end of the summer 1962, he was extremely ill. A postcard addressed to Mao Zedong, C.O. Fine Hall, Princeton, New Jersey, arrived in the mathematics department. Nash had written only a cryptic remark in French about triple tangent planes.